Hello, everyone. Let's go ahead and get started. Still out of breath running up those stairs. I am Cameron Rennie. I am the Senate Chair of the Marine Resources Committee. And today, looks like we are continuing our orientation by hearing from a variety of interested parties and organizations. So let's start out with introductions, please. All the way, start with Representative Strout over there.
Hi, everybody. I'm Tiffany Strout. I represent District 11, which is Millbridge, Harrington, Columbia, Columbia Falls, Centerville, Addison, Jonesport, Beals, Jonesboro, Roques Bluff, Whitneyville, and Machias. So eastern part of the state, lots of coastal involvement and interest. I happen to love where I live, so I'm glad I'm on this committee. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Representative Scott Landry. I represent District 75, the towns of Chesterville and Farmington, which don't have a lot to do with you folks in the seafood business or whatever, but I'll do what I can for you.
I'm Irene Gifford, District 28, and I have Howland, Enfield, Lincoln, Wynn, Matamasconis, and Edinburgh and Maxfield for my district. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jim Dill. I represent House District 26, which is Old Town, Indian Island, and Bradley on the banks of the Penobscot River.
My name is Jim Thorne. I represent House District 35, which are the towns of Carmel and Herman, and I do not have a shellfish allergies.
I'm Ken Bucket Davis. I'm District 10, which is down in the East Machias area, headed towards Princeton around. I have a total of 22 towns, along with some unorganized townships. Thank you.
I'm Holly Eaton. I live in Deer Isle, and I represent District 15, which is Deer Isle, Stonington, Brooklyn, Vinyl Haven, Swans Island, Idaho, Southwest Harbor, Frenchboro, and Tremont. And yes, I did have to just write them down because last time I forgot.
Thank you very much. So as we go through our speakers today, I think it makes the most sense for people to be able to ask questions as it comes up. This horseshoe feels more like a line than a horseshoe. So feel free to just say something or wave your hand at me. Don't be shy, okay? And as you know, as it's orientation, I just want to remind everybody we're mostly getting the general information, the lay of the land, and to put some names and faces together, as well as know who we can go to when we need more input or have questions. Okay. So with that, let's get started. Marianne LaCroix. LaCroix.
All right. Hi. We haven't been in person for a while. So thank you for having me here today. I'm Marianne LaCroix. I'm the Executive Director of the Maine Lobster Marketing Collaborative. And with me today is Kara Morrison, our Marketing Manager. And we're a two-person organization, so this is it that's here today. So I noticed it's a lot of new members on the committee, so I just wanted to give some general background, as you said, about our organization. So the collaborative was founded in 2013. It replaced the Maine Lobster Promotion Council, which was started in 1991. So there has been a marketing organization for the lobster industry in Maine since 1991. With the Promotion Council, it didn't really grow as the industry was growing. So by 2013, it was, you know, people were looking at it and saying, this industry has gotten very big. You know, the promotion councils isn't, the funding hasn't really kept up. So the decision was made at that time to restructure the organization and refund the organization. So that was all done. We're governed by a board of directors that is made up of fishermen, dealers, processors, two public members, and two commissioners from Marine Resources and DECD.
and we are fully funded by the industry. So every year when a fisherman, dealer, or processor pulls their license, there's a marketing fee on that license, and that comes to us to administer as a generic marketing program for the industry. Our funding has been about $1.9 million per year. That was changed last year when it was decided that 20% of our funds were going to be diverted to the Lobster Legal Defense Fund. So this year, we'll be looking at about $1.5 million. And again, it varies a little year to year based on, you know, what types of licenses people get. But we are currently authorized through 2026. There is a sunset clause on the organization that has varied from 2 years to 5 or 6 years. And so it was reauthorized in 2021 through 2026. So our mandate is to market and promote Maine lobster in local and national, international markets. Because we do have a limited budget, we made the strategic decision to focus on the U.S. market. And this is because there's a lot of opportunity here. There's a lot of opportunity to grow demand. And also because we're not subject to threats that that we face in international markets, such as even, you know, we could put a lot of effort into an international market. There can be a tariff or a currency exchange, you know, that is less favorable, and then that market becomes, you know, less of a good option for us. So we have been focusing on the U.S. And we target the full supply chain. We have programs for consumers. We target wholesale customers, chefs, distributors, you know, really that whole supply chain. We work, as I said, we're a two-person organization. We work with a marketing firm with our team based in Boston to run the marketing program, which, you know, varies year to year based on what's happening with market conditions. So the consumer program, we always have a public relations program. We want to make sure that Maine lobster is out there in the headlines with positive stories. We want people to be thinking about new ways to use lobster. We have developed all sorts of recipes, photos, videos, how-to. Our website is a great source of information for if you need to, you know, recipe ideas, how to cook lobster, where to buy lobster. We send people to directories that we have on our website that include, you know, direct to consumer sites as well as sites for wholesale customers. And in the past few years, something that's become more important or sort of higher profile for us is protecting the brand reputation of Maine lobster. And that is primarily because of the regulations around North Atlantic right whales. There's been a lot more media scrutiny on the industry, a lot of media coverage about it. And we just want to make sure that the fisheries perspective is being shared as that coverage goes out. So we've been focusing a lot of attention on everything that the fishery's done for the past 20 years to protect right whales. We have a website dedicated to information about that, where we have fact sheets, videos, timelines, you know, it's just sort of all sorts of information. And it was especially, you probably read about it in the fall when two different organizations that provides sustainability certifications decided that the Maine lobster fishery did not meet their criteria as a sustainable fishery. And because buyers use those certifications to determine which products they should have on their shelves, that was very, very concerning to us. We knew it was happening, and we were able to get out in front of those decertifications so that we had, for example, the Marine Stewardship Council, when that was announced in November, we had a webinar lined up that we had invited customers to so they could come to that and learn about what was going on, what the fishery had done, and all the steps we'd taken to protect right whales. And we're told from the dealers that this information was really helpful to them. A lot of customers that we had expected to drop Maine lobster have continued to carry it, which is great. It's so important to the industry that, you know, we keep as many customers as possible. So that's something that, again, that we've been working on, because right before Christmas, there was a 6-year pause on any new regulations. We figured there's not going to be quite as much attention on it moving forward as there was this past fall, but it will continue to be an issue that we handle from a marketing standpoint moving forward. We also always look for ways to stretch our budget. And one of the ways that we do that is with partnerships. So we work with different organizations that can help extend our budget. Two of those are Food Export and the Maine International Trade Center. They both do marketing of Maine lobster for international buyers, which is great since we're focusing on the U.S. And they're focusing on international buyers. That works out really well. We make sure they have all our content, all our materials. They're able to translate them into other languages, use them in different markets. We help them set up spokespeople. We've had fishermen travel, all over the world as spokespeople to talk about the industry. And we do partnerships like that, that really helps make sure that Maine lobster is being promoted worldwide. We also work with local tourism associations, regional tourism associations, and of course, always very closely with the dealers, processors, and lobstermen in the state to make sure that our program is meeting their needs and is aligned with what they're working on. From a measurement standpoint, we use general marketing metrics to evaluate how well the program's doing. And we're just actually finalizing our report for 2022, and I will share that with you through email as soon as it's available. I'm also going to email a copy of our plan. We had something ready to go, but then with the changes with the right whale regulations, we're reworking that. So we have a board meeting in a couple of weeks. So I'll share that information with you. We're also have an annual audit that we're required to share with you, and that's being done this week. So as soon as we get that audit report back, that's something else that will come to you. In addition to those specific things, I'll make sure that you're all on our list for marketing updates. So we send out information about monthly on what we're doing with the program, any results and that kind of thing. And then you've got a folder on your in front of you today that includes some information, just basically a summary of the organization. I know you're hearing from a lot of different groups today, so I just wanted to remind you who we are. There's a list of events that are coming up our fisheries events, different kinds of things that you might be interested in. There's a one-sheeter that just has a few brief highlights from our program last year, and one of our right whale fact sheets that has the website on it if you want any more information about that. And I'm happy to answer any questions you have about the organization.
Representative Dudera, do you mind introducing yourself real quick, and then we'll go to questions?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Hi, everybody. Vicki Dudera. I represent I'm the state representative for House District 41, the towns of Camden and Rockport, and I apologize for my tardiness.
Representative Bucket Davis, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you talk about marketing the Maine lobsters, is there any ID on those lobsters when they go out to the market, like on the bands? Does it say Maine? Because I've seen some in the past that said USA,
right?
But I've never seen one with a Maine band. I just wanted to know if there was a way that when these lobsters from Maine are sold, that they basically indicate that they are from Maine.
Yeah, it's a great question, one we've actually struggled with for years. And we did try doing the Maine identified bands a number of years ago. And logistically, it was a very difficult program to make happen, just because the logistics really didn't work for it. So what we tend to do is focus the majority of our promotions during the high season. So during the summer and fall, when we know the majority of lobster on the market will be Maine lobster, that's when we're doing our promotions. We do some stuff. The marketing that we do over the winter tends to focus more on a processed product, which would be identified in its, if it's, packaged tails or whatever, it would have that kind of Maine marking on it.
I'm surprised that at the restaurants, you can go in and get a boiled lobster or whatever, but I'll tell you something's real good. It's scrambled eggs with lobster meat. It's some great. Down from where I'm from, a lot of the old people, that's what they have for breakfast.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'll have to see if we have a recipe for that.
And it should be fresh eggs, too.
Okay. Made eggs.
Representative Thorne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. All of a sudden, I feel like a lobster omelet. And that was my question, is along the same lines, but a little different. Is there anything that delineates, or by definition, what a Maine lobster is? In other words, is it where it's caught or who catches it?
Well, it's really both. So it's lobster caught by a Maine fisherman, and the Maine fishermen have to land their lobsters in Maine. So it's, you know, if it goes to Canada and is processed, it comes back as product of Canada, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But that's a federal.
And a follow up for me. When I was a young airman up in Alaska, a restaurant featured on their sign Maine lobster, and it was obviously rock lobster. Mm. It had no claws. So I'm just curious if there is any prosecutorial process where you can defamation of good lobster. trademark.
Well, the FDA has regulations on what can be called lobster without something else in front of it, and it's pretty specific. So when we have had issues with that in the past, like a chain restaurant might be serving a dish with lobster in it, and it turns out it's langostino or something like that. And what we've done is contact the organization, point out the FDA regulations, and that's generally solved the problem without going to legal recourse.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Landry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your presentation. Is any of your budget targeted towards the battle between the whales and the gear? Are you getting into that side of it, or are you just promoting lobster, period?
We're promoting lobster. We're working on the reputational side of it. The legal side is being handled by the Department of Marine Resources and the Maine Lobstermen's Association, primarily.
Okay, good.
Thank you. As I said, the 20% of the marketing funds have been diverted to that legal defense fund, but our organization isn't, that's going out to the union and the MLA, not to, we're not administering those funds from our organization.
Good. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Marianne.
And I'll bring lobster rolls next time. Clearly, there's an appetite.
Careful what you promise. Let's see. So next up, Virginia Olson from the Maine Lobstering Union.
Good afternoon. Nice to see so many new faces and some of our old faces as well. My name is Virginia Olson. I am a commercial lobsterman. I'm a fifth generation lobster fisherman, and I also work for District 4 of the IAM. I'm called a business rep and organizer, which equals the same as a director for the other organizations. One of the questions I get most often is, what is the difference between our organization, the Maine Lobstering Union, and the MLA? So basically, the Maine Lobstering Union is comprised of only licensed lobstermen and their sternmen. We belong to the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. We're a national organization. We're comprised of about 600,000 active and retired members. We have members from Boeing to Harley-Davidson. If there is an issue for one member, then it's an issue for all of us. We believe that working people should exercise their rights cooperatively and economically for the benefit of all people. We're also affiliates with the AFL-CIO. So why a union in the lobster industry? The Machinists Union has been around for over 130 years. We didn't want to reinvent the wheel. We just wanted a new cog in the wheel for us. The IAM is a very strong machinist nonpartisan league in DC, and they have a phenomenal education system for anyone that's willing to learn. We have a school that is in Maryland. We send members down completely free of charge. We provide lodging, food, education, if it's a computer or software, or just teaching them how to come and advocate for their own industry. That is all covered by the union. The Maine Lobstering Union has approximately 200 members. That fluctuates depending on the time of year, whether they're a year-round fisherman or an inshore fisherman. Their dues are paid monthly while fishing. They have an unemployment stamp that they can use when they're not actively fishing. Members of Local 207 also own their own co-op, Lobster 207, making each and every member there also a dealer. So none of these have been easy issues for them. This has all been a challenge to undertake. It takes changing the mindset of a fisherman to being their own dealer and how to handle their product at times. And some of those conversations are difficult. Local 207 is dedicated to working with the 131st Legislature, the department, and all the organizations to defend, secure, and protect our lobstermen, the fishery they protect, and in which their families and their communities which rely on this fishery. I'll be here throughout the session whenever I'm needed. You will all have my contact information. If you have any questions, feel free at any time to reach out to me. As Mary Ann said, we're also a part of the litigations in DC with MLA and DMR. It is definitely a very difficult place for fishermen to be in right now, not knowing the future of their industry. We just got a six-year stay on the phased approach that they're taking. I spent 2 days in DC. One of the things that the union brings to the table is a network of members throughout the United States. So we were able to go to different senators and representatives in other states where we have a large concentration of members and bring those senators to the table in those discussions to support us. And that was a really good feeling to come out of there and know that we had people around the United States supporting us. So I guess that is kind of who we are, what we do, and be happy to answer any questions.
Go for it.
Heaven forbid you should not be asked a question, Jenny. You're like Savoir Faire. I'm dating myself on mice, but you're everywhere. Everywhere I go, there you are. And you have traveled far and wide on behalf of lobstermen. Your membership, I'm just curious, how many licensed lobstermen and women are there in the state of Maine, and what percentage would this translate to?
So for licensed lobstermen, we have this year, I'm not sure the new numbers, but we have under 5,000, so yeah. It's right. 4,500. Yeah. So we only have 200 of those. So we're a small portion. We have not been around nearly as long as the other organizations have. We've only started in 2012.
I see.
So we're a new organization to Maine.
Okay.
We began when there was an early shed of lobster in 2012. The waters were warm and the shedder season happened in the spring instead of July and August. It's kind of been moving later and later as climate change is affecting. So that was what started the conversation of start having a union.
Okay. And follow up, if I may, Madam Chair. We were down to Beals when we did the, I forget the term for a clam, a bivalve. Thank you. And certain temperatures, water temperatures, trigger shedding, mating, whatever it may be, and they artificially trigger that in the clams and the scallops and oysters. Has anybody talked about possibly lobster along those same lines doing anything?
Like a hatchery?
Yeah.
So we had a hatchery in Stonington for several years. And they stopped the hatchery. At that time, it was Penobscot East Resource Center. Holly will remember it. I wish we had more hatcheries, quite frankly. I think it would be a good thing to have. The state doesn't feel it's really a viable option. But I do think that they would be beneficial.
It's like 5 years for a egg to get to.
Yeah. And they found Brian Beal. that the larger the container they put them in when they're at a small size, quicker they grow.
I see.
So I think we didn't have that knowledge when we had the hatchery in Zone C. Mm-hmm. But once they got to an adult size, or not adult, but large enough to put out in the wild, mm-hmm. they were put all over the place. So it wasn't just in Zone C that they placed them. Mm. But we've definitely had record landings in Zone C for years. Mm. So it couldn't hurt.
Something to consider.
Correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Dudera.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's interesting that the Maine Lobstering Union is with, again, some employees that seem very, very different than kind of the solitary men and women who are out there fishing. So I'm wondering, what is your, and as you said, you've only got 200 members, you want to grow that. It's a very small percentage of mm-hmm. the amount of fishermen that are out there. What is your biggest argument that you tell them to join the union?
For me, it is not the fact that they have their own co-op in Lobster 207. For me, it is the educational piece and the fact that they learn how to advocate for themselves. It is the solidarity that it brings within the union. I think that all members of the union stand up together with each other, and that solidarity is pretty special to feel once you've actually been in there and dealt with that. They're not alone. I have dealt with clams for years. We've had a wholesale retail shellfish business. It's the first thing I started with my husband almost 30 years ago. But I always came up here to advocate on shellfish issues originally, and I did it by myself. And then once I joined the union, I wasn't by myself anymore. I had a group of people that I could talk to about issues that would help prop me up, and I did for them. So when I say one issue is an issue for all of us, that is ultimately the core of that. There is a support like I have never felt. Several years, 2016, our boat sunk in the middle of the winter during scallop season. My husband was on it. And I had a board meeting the following day. I had to drive 3 hours. I went to a board meeting. Everyone that fishes knows that fishing on an inshore fishing family this time of year, you don't have income. You learn how to budget. You put your money away in the summer. You pay your bills ahead for the winter. And I went to my meeting. I had to do my job. I was the recording secretary. You have to be there. And everyone there just engulfed me in support and in love. Everyone busted out their wallet to give me $100 bills around the table. That didn't happen in my hometown, but it happened with my brothers and sisters at the union, because I got calls from people outside of Portland wanting to drive to Stonington to come help me because they wanted to do anything they could to help. To me, that is a support system that you just don't have all the time. And that means something that's valuable.
Thanks. That was great, Jenny. Thank you. Thank you. Next up is the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association, Ben Martins.
Thank you all for taking the time to meet with us and join everybody. So my name is Ben Martins, and I'm the executive director of the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association. And we are a nonprofit, fisherman's-based nonprofit. And we identify and foster ways to restore the fisheries of the Gulf of Maine and restore Maine's fishing communities for future generations. And we work directly with fishermen on policies and community advocacy projects. And we support stewardship, science-based decision-making, equitable access to our ocean's natural resources, and policies that support diverse fishing businesses in Maine and beyond. And our fisheries policy work is mostly focused on the other fisheries of Maine. We don't really work with the lobster fishery on policy initiatives. We work with them on different projects within their community, but we focus on the groundfish fishery, the federal scallop fishery, monkfish, halibut, herring, tuna, the things that are outside the 3-mile limit that many fishermen historically in Maine used as part of their yearly round, but have been on the decline, both in terms of access and the natural resources for many years. So we work in those other fisheries, and we organize fishermen to bring their voice into the policy arena. So we worked recently with a bunch of fishermen that target scallops in the federal fisheries. That's called the Northern Gulf of Maine Scallop Fishery. And we were going to lose access to that fishery to larger boats from New Bedford that were coming into the Gulf of Maine. So we organized fishermen. We protected that access through the New England Fishery Management Council. Last year, with climate change, warming waters, we had an abundance of scallops in our federal waters. We landed almost 600,000 pounds of scallops out of that fishery at a time of year when many of the fishermen who are groundfish fishermen or lobster fishermen were able to buy permits or use their permits that they had to participate in scallops. So it's those types of opportunities that we try and invest in, work with the Department of Marine Resources and local fishermen to identify opportunities in these other diverse fisheries, and then help fishermen embrace and build their businesses around those different opportunities. So one of the things that we bring as a asset is that we play in those other fisheries, so we know how permits work. Federal fisheries permits operate very differently than the state permits that you may be more familiar with. You can buy and trade permits in the federal marketplace. So a scallop permit for the Northern Gulf of Maine, right now that costs $150,000. That is a significant investment for somebody to make. So we are able to sit down with them and talk about the risks, the markets, think about what that does to the other permits that you might have. If you have a scallop permit and a lobster permit, there's different sets of reporting that you have to do. And so when fishermen are thinking about taking their business and moving it forward, adding diversity of catch to their business platform, their boat, their permit makeup, that's a 360-degree view of understanding markets, permits, regulations, and that's what we can sit down and provide with them. So we worked with a lot of fishermen over the past 3 or 4 years to buy scallop permits, to buy groundfish permits. Despite the groundfish fishery being on the decline in Maine over the past 20 years, we've had more fishermen in the lobster fishery reach out to us to purchase groundfish permits for the past 2 years than in my previous 10 years of working in this space. And that's because we're seeing fish in the ocean, and fishermen are worried about what their future might look like with the lobster fishery and other issues that are coming. And so they want to stay on the water. They want to continue to fish. They want to look at that diversity of options. So we operate the Maine Coast community sector in the groundfish fishery. Those are fish like cod, haddock, flounder. That is managed in a very strange way, but it's basically they allocate out pounds of fish. So it's a cap and trade system. You have to be part of a sector to operate within that system. We operate that sector in Maine. We've also partnered with the Nature Conservancy to go out and buy permits to park in that sector so that fishermen can get access to that cap and trade quota and build out their businesses. We bought about 28 permits with the Nature Conservancy, and we lease those pounds of fish annually to active fishermen at a reduced rate, prioritizing folks that are doing things in the research arena, or if they are fishing using sustainable fishing methods as well. So that's a way that we've invested in the business security of a subset of the fleet in the groundfish fishery. The other piece of that, just to flag, is that we don't have a lot of infrastructure left for the groundfish fishery. It's in Portland, in the Portland Fish Exchange. And so our organization is very closely tied to the success of that entity. And I would encourage you all, as you're thinking about the infrastructure needs and the marine resources, that that entity is going through some transitional changes right now. And a field trip down to the Portland Fish Exchange would be a fantastic opportunity to learn a little bit about groundfish, see what happens down there, talk to some of the fishermen, and it's not too far away. And so I would heavily encourage that. Pivoting to a couple of the projects that we work with closer to home. So that's our policy work in the federal waters. We also recognize that you need access. So it doesn't matter how many fish are in the ocean. If you can't get to them, they're not going to do a lot of good for those of us in our rural communities in Maine. And so we have community work that's focused on access. So both permits and working waterfront, seafood, trying to make sure that there's a market for those products to be sold into, and then wellness. So I'm going to quickly hit on our working waterfront work. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about our program called the Fisherman Feeding Mainers program as well. But working waterfront is a hot topic in Maine right now, as we have shifting communities, as we have gentrification taking place in a lot of places. And unfortunately, we don't actually know that much about our working waterfront in Maine. It is up to the municipalities to kind of regulate their own working waterfronts. We have one program, the Land for Maine's Future program, that invests in working waterfront protections. The Department of Marine Resources administers, and they've been doing some great work. Not all the working waterfronts that's important in Maine fits well into that program. And a lot of the municipalities that we work with, they don't know what they have. They don't know what's privately owned. They don't know what's publicly owned. They don't know what might be at risk for conversion, both to a marina or to a condo, a hotel, a high-end a housing apartment. So there's a lot of uncertainty in our working waterfront infrastructure. And if you're thinking about a state like Maine, where access to the oceans is a priority and really one of the core competencies, whether it's access for fishing or aquaculture businesses, we need to protect our working waterfront, and we need to invest in our working waterfront. So one of the projects that we've done is we've recognized two threats. One is conflict. So as new people are coming into our communities, they don't always know what it's like to live in a working waterfront. In the handouts that I passed around, we have a new publication that came from us that is called Scuttlebutt. And it's basically a how to live in a working waterfront community guide that we produced in partnership with the community of Harpswell. So anybody who moves to Harpswell gets handed one of these guides now. We've worked with all the real estate agents. We've worked with all the rentals, all the different businesses, the town hall. It's like, you need to understand there might be smells. There might be noises. There might be people that are working in, with lights on early in the morning. We started this project because there was complaints in the town office about a beeping from a working waterfront property at 5 a.m. It's like, that's the forklift. The beeping is that's required. You have to do that, but they didn't understand that. And so what tends to happen in these situations is conflict starts to brew. And instead of having better communication and understanding, that's when you start to get in a push me, pull me fight that never results well for anybody within a community. So mitigating conflict is one of our top priorities within communities. We're doing that through conversations, through publications, and education around our working waterfronts. And then the other piece is we are about to launch a working waterfront inventory project where we have gone out and we've developed a platform so that communities can go through and inventory their own working waterfront, either through volunteers or through partnerships. And basically, it's like, these are where you go to learn about working waterfront. Here are the places you go to figure out what kind of permits you might have. So basically, it's a step-by-step guide for a community or municipality to inventory their own working waterfront. We're going to be working with a handful of communities this summer to test out what we have produced. But that is a baseline that we need to start to establish and then track over time to know what is shifting, what is changing, and what is most at risk within working waterfronts. The final piece I'll just share about our work is going back to the groundfish fishery, is that during COVID, groundfish in Maine mostly ended up in restaurants. And prior to COVID, that's what we did. We sold it into high-end restaurants. When COVID struck, all those restaurants closed. And so we had fishermen that were literally going out, filling their boats with fish, coming back home, and it was being sold into the lobster bait market. And it was a huge loss. And at the same time, we were hearing about food insecurity in our state spiking. So we have an abundance of protein, no place to take it. So we went out and we built a program called Fisherman Feeding Mainers. We were incredibly lucky in that we were able to get some support from several foundations to kind of try it out. So we bought fish from fishermen at a stable price. We paid local processors in Portland to cut that fish. And then we donated into schools, local food insecure populations, any nonprofit that was working with food insecurity that needed access and wanted fish. We said, sure. We're paying for it. It's yours. We worked closely with Good Shepherd Food Bank. And it was really successful. It helped stabilize price for the fishermen, and the need within our communities was amazing. With that kind of trial balloon that we put out there, we were then able to work with the Department of Marine Resources and the governor's office in Maine to use COVID relief funds that were set aside for the fishing industry to go out and buy fish to do this, keep this project going. So it started in October of 2020. As of last week, we had bought 587,000 pounds of groundfish in the state of Maine. And we had turned that into close to a million meals for those in need in our state. And it's been incredibly impactful. And it's been a lot of a lot of work to get there, but a lot of support from our state. And it's been revealing for us to understand the intricacies and the connections in the local food system that don't really exist in our state. When we talk about feeding people good quality food, fish and seafood is not a part of that equation until we forced it in there by providing free meals. All of our schools, like we have over 50 schools that have received seafood donations from us. They could not afford that without this program. And we've been working with chefs and those within those schools to learn how to cook fish, understand fish. The first donation we made to a school was actually thrown away because they got fresh fish and they didn't use it within 2 days. And they were like, well, we got to get rid of this now. And they threw it away. And so we had to do a lot of education as well about like that fish was landed 2 days ago. You've got some time to play with it. So there's a lot of that type of work that went into this. And so I share that because it has been a fantastic project. There's been a lot of benefits and it's kept the boats fishing in Maine. Without a huge influx of cash, we've been able to do a lot of good in cities and communities like Portland and Harpswell and Port Clyde that have been really profoundly impacted by market fluctuations. So I will stop there and open up if there's any questions about that piece of work or anything else. There's a lot of information about what we do in the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association to support the other fisheries in our state. So, thank you.
Representative Dudera.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Is it Martens?
Yeah, you got it.
Great. Fascinating. And thank you for the report about the, you know, feeding the insecure with the fish. I mean, we love it when we hear about two challenges being solved at once. That's just terrific. I'm also a real estate agent in Camden and in the area down there and have done that for 20 years. So I'm very familiar with the people who want to go see property in Port Clyde and get down there and just kind of look around and are like, oh, but look at the trucks or, you know, or I hear noise or, you know, so this is such a great publication. And it seems to me it is fair. You've got some information about Harpswell and I understand that there were Harpswell nonprofits who helped you probably with the funding behind it. But otherwise, it's pretty generic. It'd be great to have something like this that was a total generic thing that could go to other coastal communities where we're also facing this, because the last thing anybody in real estate wants is to have unhappy customers whose expectations are totally different than what they buy into. And we want people who are going to move into communities with working waterfronts and support it, not fight against it. So is there grant money available where you could do that kind of thing?
Number two,
I'm also hoping that you'll report back to us about your findings on the loss, not the loss, but you, as you put it, a study on sort of what are waterfront areas that are at risk.
Absolutely. So, we will definitely be reporting that once we start to collect a little bit more information and work with the municipalities. So I would say, we are not overly interested in doing a generic publication because we think all of these communities are pretty unique, special. And one of the things that we tried to do is make that into a document that people will hold on to. So in the back of that document, there are phone numbers and people to contact in the community of Harpswell so that you get that, right? Okay. And you're like, I want to hold on to this, right?
Yeah.
And so we are actually trying to reach out to other communities to say, who wants to do this? We've got, like, as you said, there's a lot of there that's already generic that you can kind of take and pull in, plug and play. But we're hoping that a place like Camden, like St. George, the other communities would say, you know, it's not going to take a lot of funds to make something like that happen. And so we're hopeful that we can start to build used as a tool to engage communities in the conversation. We find it much more meaningful when you start a real conversation over it, as opposed to just handing somebody a tool, because typically that tool ends up on a shelf and doesn't get used. So if you've got folks in your community that might be interested in talking to us, we would absolutely love to. We're actually working on something with the Kennebunkport community right now on a different version of the publication, because we've heard pretty loud and clear from folks that we've shared it with that there's a value there. So
thank you. Yeah, I mean, St. George really is the community that comes to mind. So I'll talk to our good representative from St. George and
that's great.
Get her on it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Landry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The permits, licenses, quite pricey. What's the lifespan of a license?
Yeah, so for a federal license, once you own it, it's yours.
And you can sell it.
Yeah.
And so gift it or whatever.
Yeah, you can sell it. You can gift it. Different fisheries have different values associated with those permits, and they can fluctuate dramatically depending upon what's available in the ocean. With, a groundfish permit, it could cost from $10,000 to over $1 million, depending upon what the history is associated with it. So it can be a very significant investment for a small business to contemplate making.
And they're limited to certain areas?
Depending on the permit, they can be either limited to certain areas, certain sized vessels, certain types of fisheries. So there's a lot of complexities that go into it. The scallop permit that I was referring to is only available, like you can only catch the scallops north of 4220 in the Gulf of Maine for that permit.
Good. Thank you very much.
No problem.
Interesting.
On that note, we'll just keep moving right along. Who do we have next? Maine Aquaculture Association, Sebastian Bell.
Come on down.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you very much. My name is Sebastian Bell. I come from Halliwell and I used to live in South Bristol. So my kids went to Lincoln Academy and it was a great school and it served them well. For those of you who were on the Maine Development Foundation tour, you've already got this folder. So you don't have to take a second one, but really appreciate you making the time for me today. The Maine Aquaculture Association is the oldest state aquaculture association in the country. We were founded in the 70s, and we were founded by a group of faculty and graduate students from University of Maine, University of New Hampshire, Bowdoin and Colby College. And all of those folks went on to found their own farms, and are many of them are still in the business as commercial growers in the state of Maine. We have a representative board of directors, so our members grow finfish, shellfish, and seaweed, and our board of directors is designed to represent both the species they grow, as well as the size of the company, as well as the production method they use. So as an example, in the case of oysters, we have three board members. One is a surface cage growing grower, one is a bottom culture grower, and one is a hatchery owner. So that's just an example of within each species group, how it's represented for the diversity purposes. And I think, if I recall correctly, over half of my board is women. And we have a tremendously active group of female entrepreneurs in the state who are growing companies. And that's a really kind of cool part of my world. Our members grow animals and plants both in freshwater and saltwater. So they grow both on land and in the ocean. And we have, by the latest account, I think we have an operation in every county in the state of Maine. Which is kind of interesting. So we do have some members that are way up in the mountains. They're using beautiful, high quality fresh water to raise salmon and trout. And then we have members that are down on the coast and are using both freshwater and saltwater. Probably one of the things which is not known about our sector, but is known at a national and international level, was the Maine Aquaculture Association was the first group of commercial growers actually in the world to come up with best management practices that were then third-party audited. So what that means is we come up with a series of methods that we use to grow our animals and plants. Those are focused on sustainability. And then we put those out to be audited by a third party. So in the case of, for example, Cook Aquaculture, which is our large salmon grower, they're certified by two international groups that come in and audit their farms often on a monthly basis to make sure that they are complying with their environmental standards. Those are over and above the regulations, right? So the standards are established by an international body and then they're audited. And those are higher than the regulations we have here in the state. And we have a very robust regulatory environment in the state of Maine. As an example, we probably have the strictest fish health regulations in the country and in some cases in the world. And we should be proud of that. And your predecessors on this committee have been part of that, establishing those rules and regulations. And it protects us as farmers to make sure that there aren't people out there who are kind of cowboys or cowgirls not operating responsibly. You may have heard we've had some controversy around our sector, and we will continue to have controversy over the next couple of years. Glad to answer any questions about any of that. We have roughly 156 ocean farms in the state, and those go all the way from the New Hampshire border to the Canadian border. Then we have an additional 7-8 land-based operations. And you probably have heard we've got some larger land-based operations that are proposed. We have three of them that have been fully permitted. None of them has started construction yet. They probably, the one that will start construction first will be the one in Jonesboro. I think that'll be the first one that'll break ground. We employ 700 people, 725 people on a year-round basis. Jonesboro. I think that'll be the first one that'll break ground. We employ 700 people, 725 people on a year-round basis. And I had a great moment in one of my board meetings the other day where one of our younger members came to me and said, Sebastian, I've grown my company to the point where I can now offer benefits to my employees. And he's a mussel grower down in Casco Bay, and he was very proud of that fact. And I think that's kind of an indication of how our sector is growing. We've grown slowly but steadily. Some people will say that we're explosively growing, and I would say just look at the data and you'll see that we've averaged about 2% growth per year over the last 20 years. That's compared to about 8% per year annually at a global level. So our international competitors are growing much faster than we are, and we do compete in an international market. It's a little bit different than the lobster industry in the sense that lobstering, we land a lot of the lobster that's in the marketplace in this state of Maine. In our case, whether it's oysters, salmon, seaweed, mussels, we are infinitesimal compared to the production that happens in other places in the world. And so we have to compete against those companies. Many of those companies and countries don't have the kinds of environmental regulations or labor regulations that we have. And so the advantage we have is proximity to market. We are within a 24-hour truck drive of 130 million consumers. So that's Atlanta North, Chicago East. And that's the market that we compete in, is the East Coast fresh market. And we're very good at competing in that because we are so close to the market and because we come out of clean water in Maine. The Maine brand counts for a lot in the seafood industry. All of us who are in the seafood business are proud that we grow stuff or harvest stuff in Maine. And that high environmental quality is reflected, for us at least, in the marketplace. Typically, depending on whether you're talking about oysters, mussels, or salmon, we might get as much as 20-25% more in terms of price in the marketplace than our competitors. And it's really because of the Maine brand, because we're so close to markets, because the environmental quality is so high here in Maine. We generate roughly between $80 and $100 million in gross revenues on an annual basis. So that's the point of first sale. So there's no multipliers in there. That's just what the farmer gets paid. That goes up and down because we have a kind of a unique salmon farming method in the state of Maine. In the year 2000, we shifted to a production method called all-in, all-out site rotation. And it's a method that's actually been used in the organic farming community for many, many years. And what it means is we stock a farm, we stock all the farms in a bay at the same time, we raise those fish up, and then we harvest them all at the same time, and we leave that bay fallow for about a year. So on any given year, 30% of our salmon farms are being fallowed in a site rotation. Since we did that, we've only used antibiotics twice, and that's quite an accomplishment if you compare our salmon farms to other salmon farms around the world. In the case of shellfish and seaweed, we're about to go back and redo our best management practices. They were done 15 years ago. The technology and the methods have evolved quite a bit, and so we're going to redo that. That will be an exercise that we will lead the growers through. They will develop their own best management practices, and then they will go out to scientific review to an expert panel to look at them and see whether or not they're up to snuff. I want to just highlight, and Jim Deal will appreciate this, State of Maine is very lucky. We have the best, bar none, research and development infrastructure for cold water marine aquaculture research in North America, not just in America, but including Canada. And a lot of that is with the university, the facilities they have, their expertise that they bring to bear. We use that all the time to solve problems that we're facing. Farming is farming. Every year is different, and every year brings a new challenge. And the university is really critical in helping us solve those problems. The three areas that we focus on from an association point of view are training of new farmers. So we're quite similar to MOFCA in the sense that we have programs that take new growers, train them in methods, make sure that they don't make the same mistakes that we did when we first started a long time ago. The development of best management practices, which I've talked about earlier, and then business support services. We have a full-time economist, Christian Braden. All he does is work with new farmers, helping them develop business plans, production plans, risk management plans, any sort of challenge that they might have as a new farmer, Christian will go to work on. And just as an example, one of the challenges we have as a sector is financing, because we're kind of new and a lot of people don't know about our business. So Christian developed the first set of what are called benchmarking studies in America. So he benchmarked all the different species and kinds of production methods we have. Those are now routinely used by the banking community. When somebody comes to the bank and says, we would like to apply for a loan to start an oyster farm, they pick up the benchmarking study and compare the application to that benchmarking. And it tells the bank whether or not that person is kind of in the ballpark for where they should be from an economic performance point of view. The final piece I'll just leave you with is we as an association are very focused on strategic partners, strategic partnerships. The working waterfront community is comprised of a lot of different groups. And right from the very beginning, my board of directors has always been focused on how do we work with our colleagues of the working waterfront. We were one of the founding members of the Working Waterfront Coalition when it was founded many years ago. We founded also with some of our colleagues on the land side, the Natural Resources Network. That's a network that includes all the way from snowmobilers to forestry people to farming folks. I sit on the Fishermen Forum's board of directors. I do that because Fishermen's Forum is a really important event for all of us in the working waterfront. I sit on the National MAFAC Federal Advisory Committee, which advises NOAA fisheries on policy at the national level. And I am currently, and this is one of those things where you be careful what you wish for, I'm the elected president of the National Aquaculture Association. That is an interstate association that we lobby and work on policy at a national level with all the states in the country, not just coastal states, but also inland freshwater states. I will stop there and thank you for your patience. You will see me a bunch of times this year. The only thing I will say, and Ben Martens alluded to this, probably if you were to ask me what our single biggest challenge is gentrification on the coastline and the shift in values in coastal communities around commercial use versus non-commercial use of the wonderful ocean that we're all privileged to see and live and work around. Gentrification is the biggest challenge for us. And it often drives the public debate around aquaculture. When you hear a lease coming up for renewal, when you hear a lease coming up for granting that DMR, Deirdre and Pat Kelleher, the commissioner, deal with, most of the time, the controversy around those applications has to do with the fact the communities, the people who live in those communities are not used to using the ocean for commercial purposes. And there's no mechanism in the law right now to allow for consideration of viewscape, when those leases come up. And that's intentional. That's something that this legislative body has chosen for many, many years. It's come before this committee, it's come before this legislature many, many times over the years. And everybody, in at least historically, has said, we value working waterfronts, and viewscapes is not a criteria that we are going to use to judge whether or not a project should or should not go forward. Thank you very much.
Representative Dudera.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm the one with all the questions today, huh?
It's usually Representative Thorne.
Yeah. Or Strout down there. She likes to ask her questions too. I'm not quite sure how to ask this, Mr. Bell, but I'm thinking about how, what a wonderful industry this is for young people. And when we were on the tour and we saw the video, I've met Shay Conover before when I represented Islesboro and seen her operation and the oyster guy up in Hancock. And it's just such a good entree. And there's so many, you know, young, energetic people working in this industry, and it's small, and it's, you know, we all feel so proud of it. But it, what seems to happen in a lot of cases in Maine is this is the way it starts. And then people come in from outside, and it grows and it grows. And then the young folks maybe can't get into it anymore. Right. And is this something that's you see on the radar? I know gentrification is a big issue, but is that something? And how are you maybe working, you know, to protect the industry? Although people have a right certainly to grow a business if they want to, as big as they want to, but.
Yeah, so there are three things that we have in, and first of all, thank you for your question, and a very fair question. And there are people who are concerned about the issue of consolidation and how when you start small, you get bigger and bigger, and then the big guys take over and little guys get squeezed out, right? That's the concern. Maine has in statute provisions that would limit that ability. So as an example, the individual size of a lease cannot be over 100 acres. Okay, so that's one cap that we have. The second cap we have is the total number of acres that an individual company can lease. And always remember, this is a lease. This is not an ownership. This is something that can be revoked at any time by the state agencies that have jurisdiction over this sector. So if somebody does something bad, there's a process that you go through, not just with DMR, but in the case of FinFish, with DEP. So there's two agencies plus federal agencies that have the ability to revoke permissions. But so there's also a total cap on the number of acres that an individual company could lease. That total cap is 1,000 acres. But in order to get over 500 acres, you as a company have to file with the DMR a site rotation and fallowing plan, right? So you can't go over that 500 acres unless you've got a site rotation and fallowing plan with the Department of Marine Resources, and they approve it. They review and approve it. The reason for that cap was because when those limits were put in place, we were shifting to the site rotation and fallowing process with the salmon farming. And so we knew that we had three bays in the state that all had salmon farms in them. In order to make sure that we didn't have to lay people off every year, we wanted to allow a company to have more than the 500 acres. Currently, Cook Aquaculture has roughly over 600 acres. By the way, that's the size of an average potato farm in Aroostook County, just for the record, right? So the total number of acres in the state of Maine is 1,750 acres that we lease. That's three potato farms. But that cap was put in place to prevent that kind of large kind of coming in and taking over everything. And then the final thing, which is, I think, very important, and unless you really are in the minutiae and read the rules and regulations very exactly, Maine has an anti-speculation clause in their aquaculture leasing, which means that you cannot just acquire leases to speculate in a market to sell those off to somebody else. And that's really important. And that's actually that anti-speculation clause was put in place a long time ago. We've supported it always because we don't want to see that kind of, you know, consolidation over time. But the other side of this is, in order to compete in an international market, scale is important, right? In order, we have no choice. We're not competing against a bunch of people from another country that have a limit on the size of the company they can have. And so We have to have the ability to scale over time. But the, it's I think, and obviously I'm an advocate for the sector, but I have worked all over the world. I've worked in a lot of other places that don't have those kinds of limits, and that kind of consolidation does happen. And I don't think that's necessarily healthy for a sector. You want a diversity of company sizes, of operational sizes. The most interesting thing for me, and we learned this in COVID, and this was completely unexpected on our part, and Ben alluded to this earlier. When COVID hit, restaurants shut down. 80% of seafood in the country was consumed in restaurants prior to COVID. 80%. So our markets evaporated overnight. The only people who had really good entry into the retail side of the seafood business were the larger companies, because they had relationships with Hannaford, with Food Lion, with, and so what happened was our large growers turned to our smaller growers and said, hey, we've got a market for what you have. Let us distribute your product through our company. If we had not had that diversity of company size, the larger companies and the smaller companies, we would have lost growers. We expected to lose 30% of our small growers in COVID, and we only lost one. And it was really because of that partnership between the larger growers and the smaller growers that helped us survive. So diversity in company size is really important, I think, for resilience in the sector. Long answer. I apologize, but yeah.
Representative Strout.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I couldn't get away with three or four people speaking without a question. So your lucky day. So there's Salmon Pens off Beals, which is part of my district. And I know they did not increase some of their lease. There's conversations about them enlarging their lease. I don't know what their specs are. And then there's also concern around Frenchman's Bay with some projects that they're not real happy about Pens going in there. And some of those conversations are because they've removed Pens from other parts of the country. And it's all the science that you find and get and look at, right? So there is some controversy with that, especially in my area. So how is that going, and how are you working with the locals, not just the pamphlets, but when they do that scientific research themselves, how are you kind of working with them together?
So, and much to my staff's horror, I never say no. So if somebody reaches out to me and says, we've got a question or concern, we sit down with them and we go through what their concerns are. And as an example, you will probably see a bill in front of you this session that's backed by a group called Oceana. We had their campaign manager come to our offices and sit down with our board and present to our board. And we listened to Matt Dumas, and we would do that with anybody. We are a very small organization, and I will just be very frank with you. Our bandwidth in terms of our ability to go to every coastal community and have a discussion with them is pretty limited. But we did, my board agreed to hire a full-time staff person. Her name is Afton Vigu. She comes from a lobster. Her dad still lobsters. Her brother still lobsters. She comes from, I think, a fifth generation lobster family. And her job description is to go and talk to communities about what their concerns are. Having said that, I will say that, and so my first degree is in fisheries biology, second in agricultural economics. I spend a lot of time reading data and scientific studies, peer-reviewed stuff. There's a lot of misinformation out there. And the challenge, I think, for people who aren't in the field in particular is sorting through the misinformation and the scientific, you know, stuff. So I will say this. The proposal in Frenchman's Bay that moved forward and that was rejected by DMR had a lot of issues with it. And if that company had come and talked to people in the sector who were familiar with Maine and kind of knew what the landscape was and what the technical considerations, and most importantly, what the actual law and rules and regulations were that would be used to review that proposal, I think they probably would have chosen somewhere else to put that project. The thing I think, which, and I fair disclosure, I worked for DMR for 3 years, many, many years ago. It was one of the most educational periods in my life. I was always the private sector guy pounding on the table saying, you bureaucrats are trying to put me out of business, my digger. When I worked for DMR, I realized how challenging it is to be a public servant and to actually balance all the different demands on you. I think DMR does an amazing job of being fair, of looking at the science, being neutral, and really pushing companies to do the right thing in the application process. For anybody who's ever applied for a lease, you know that it can take up to 3 or 4 years to get through the leasing process. Nobody in their right mind would go through that process with an application that they didn't think might have a chance of being successful. So it's a very tough process. And DMR, frankly, deserves a tremendous amount of credit for the hard work and the rigor that they give it. So.
Representative Thorne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you again
for without a question from you.
That's the way I roll. I'm just curious, now, refresher course, how long a lease is? Does it depend on the species that you're?
It depends on two things. One is what the applicant chooses to apply for. And the second is what the law allows. So the applicant can choose to apply for a period shorter than what the law allows. The law allows for up to a 20-year lease. Uh-huh. We have people who apply for a 10-year lease. We have people who apply for a 20-year lease. The reason 20 years, and again, this legislative body was the group that approved that, was because we were having difficulty financing. Because think about if you finance your home on a 30-year mortgage versus a 5-year mortgage, they charge you a little difference on the interest rate, right? And so we used to have only 10-year lease applications. And particularly for our young growers, that was really difficult for them to get financing. And so that was why we went to the 20-year lease. And remember always that even though it's 20 years, it can be revoked at any time for cause.
Yeah, follow up for me? And just the Reader's Digest version, what do they look at for consideration to renew that lease, and what would be an example of a deal breaker?
Wow, I would almost defer to Deirdre on that, but I will say this: you have to show that you were going to operate the lease in the manner and with the methods that it was originally approved for, right? So you can't substantively change what you're proposing to do at renewal. The interesting thing about the renewal process is even in the most contentious lease applications that we've had here in the state of, and we've been leasing since 1976 or 77, I think, or 74, the 70s, even in ones that have been incredibly contentious. And as an example, we've had them where we've had 3 days of hearings. Okay. So 3 full days of hearings before the DMR has all the evidence that it needs to consider whether or not to grant that lease or not. When those come up for renewal, there's virtually no opposition to renewal. What does that tell you? It tells you that, that people, it's really fear of the unknown more than anything else, which is causing people to resist these leases. And once they get up and operating, they kind of become the neighborhood farm. Now, if we have an operator that is operating irresponsibly, you can be sure that people are going to show up at that renewal process and voice their opposition to renewal. And that happens I can think of only one instance where that's happened in the time that I've been around back in the state. So, you're held to the original purpose of the lease. You're held, your record is looked at. If you've had violations or what have you, that's going to play into it. And you need to obviously earn your stripes with the community you're in.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
That's great. Thank you so much. I'm sorry, Mr. Bell, one more. No, that's fine.
That was very rude.
No, it wasn't. I said, thank you very much. I just wanted to make sure your contact information is easy to get.
It's in the folder.
That's a little more specific than it needs to be for right now.
No worries. It's in the folder. My business card is in the folder. And you can probably.
Perfect. Thank you. Awesome. Okay. Next up, we've got the Island Institute. Let's do this.
Keeps everyone awake throughout the day, right? I imagine it's incredibly distracting over on that side of the room. I'm well, Cameron. How are you? I'm just thrilled to see you in a leadership position here. And congratulations, by the way. I think this is the first time seeing you, so. Yes, happy to. Right, we're good?
Yeah.
Excellent. Senator Rennie, esteemed members of the Joint Standing Committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Sam Belknap, and I am here with my colleague, Nick Batista, to talk a little bit about the work going on at the Island Institute. We brought some supporting materials today, but most prominently, we've printed out a slide deck that will help us walk through some of the things we'd like to cover today. Starts with our Island Institute presentation, and this is our first page. So, the Island Institute was founded in 1983. We're a 40-year-old community development and economic development nonprofit located in Rockland, Maine. We have more than 50 full-time employees, including our Island Fellows, which are an AmeriCorps-style capacity initiative that brings much-needed support to island and coastal communities across the state. We originally were formed to work with Maine's 15 unbridged year-round islands, we now work with the 152 coastal communities, inclusive of those remaining 15 year-round unbridged islands. We have a strong network of partners and supporters, and we are focused on three pillars of work on the coast of Maine. One is empowering strong community leaders. The second is developing and implementing climate solutions, both for the community and the private sector. And last, and probably most importantly, seeking to create resilient economies for our coast and islands. Today, I'm going to be talking a little bit about our work on the blue economy, which is inclusive of all marine-related businesses and efforts at the Island Institute. So if you turn to slide 3 in our deck, I'll give you a snapshot of some of the other faces that you may see before you this legislative session. So in addition to myself, our team worked to support the diversity and viability of Maine's marine sector for the islands and the coast. We're thrilled to have our senior ocean scientist, Dr. Susie Arnold, our team lead, Leah Morris, our working waterfront and aquaculture specialist, Dr. Molly Miller, and our leadership specialist, Brenna Cohen, on the team. And next time you see me, we'll actually be having a new face, another Sam, joining our team to focus on implementing climate solutions for marine businesses. He's joining us next week, so we didn't yet include him here. But you may be seeing his face in the future as well. So most broadly, our blue economy focuses on three areas of work. Issues around sustainable seafood, which include our work on lobster and aquaculture. Work to support the working waterfront, and here working to support not just access and preservation issues, but issues of resilience, in particular to climate change as well, for this critical infrastructure. And also marine electrification, bringing clean energy solutions to the waterfront so that it can lead our state's efforts in addressing climate change. You will most likely see us showing up in this room on issues around working waterfront access, preservation, and resilience, around issues pertaining to aquaculture, and also around the lobster sector in Maine. One of the tools that we utilize in our communications and our work is data-driven storytelling. So you'll see a spread in the PowerPoint from our Waypoints publication, which is Maine-based data that tells various stories about how our coast is changing and how it's being impacted by economic drivers, climate drivers, other things. And you'll see a slide here from the changing lobster industry, which is a decade-long evaluation of how landings have changed across the coast, showing that the Maine lobster fishery isn't a monolith. And it's really, as Ben mentioned, each community is unique and each community is impacted differently. So we've seen a shift in landings throughout the years, that kind of sets the stage for different approaches required when we're dealing with lobstering communities. They're more or less reliant on this. They are more or less reliant on other segments of the economy as well. So one of the tools that we've utilized in addressing some of the impacts to the lobster fishery are partnerships focusing on climate-friendly fisheries. At the beginning of the pandemic, we partnered with Luke's Lobster on a multi-pronged strategy for bringing support to the lobster sector as the pandemic hit and trying to provide outlets for other seafood producers through an established national brand and their e-commerce platform that they developed. One of the deliverables of this partnership was the first of its kind full greenhouse gas analysis of the lobster supply chain of Luke's from boat to table. Or from bait to plate, as some like to call it. This is available on our website. Madam Chair, I'll leave this with you and you can share, but it's freely available. And this really highlights just how climate friendly and how sustainable our main lobster fishery is. Spoiler, the carbon footprint of a pound of lobster from Luke's supply chain is around 2.89 pounds per pound of lobster, which is far better than all other terrestrial proteins and equivalent to most other, if not lower than most other marine animal proteins. Now, as a theme of the day, we recognize the importance of our coastal infrastructure as probably being central to all ongoing economic activity that connects communities to the ocean. You'll see here a picture of our most recent report that we commissioned during the pandemic, highlighting the critical vulnerabilities of the working waterfront infrastructure along the coast, but most importantly, providing a suite of potential solutions and items that could be addressed at the state level to help ensure access and preservation. So you'll hear us speaking more about that through this session. Lastly, as I mentioned, we recognize that the marine sector and the blue economy in Maine can lead the state in achieving our climate action goals. One of our steps we're taking is to power the future through electrification and bringing electric solutions to the working waterfront. Here, we are thrilled to be introducing electric outboards up to 250 horsepower to various vessels across the coast over the next several years. We'll have one on the water this summer and would happily schedule a field trip for any interested members of this committee to come and take a ride on an electric boat there. They're impressive, to say the least. And more importantly, the technology is one thing, but providing the supporting infrastructure for that technology is critical. And part of this is training the next generation of mechanics and service folks that can address electrical engines more broadly and the specific needs of the marine sector. So in conjunction with the Maine Community College system and the Midcoast School of Technology, we've developed a three-part certification course focusing on electric boats, ranging from the history, implementation, to full-on servicing of electric engines. We're hoping that this course, which offers digital badging for interested participants, not just in Maine, but from across the country, can serve as a model for other tech schools and community college systems across the state. So while we're piloting it in the Midcoast this year, we're hoping in the years to come, it can spread to Southern Maine and down East Maine as well, as servicing of electric engines, not just on the water, will become an increasing opportunity for folks across the coast. And now I will turn it over to my colleague to talk a little bit about some of the other places and other times you may see us showing up in the halls of Augusta.
Thank you, everybody. So as I said earlier, Nick Batista, you'll see me here in Augusta on a variety of issues for the Island Institute on marine stuff. Sam described our team and the work we do with communities and partners. On other issues, it's very similar. We work with the communities, we work with our local partners. And when we come to Augusta, we're elevating the issues that we're running into them on a day-to-day basis and hopefully proposing some good solutions. Just wanted to say we've been very active in the climate change realm. We have a couple of staff who work on the Maine, who support Maine Climate Council's various subcommittees, including our colleague Susie Arnold, who's the co-chair of the Science and Technical Subcommittee. You'll see us on a variety of clean energy issues, from community energy transitions to some of the electric outboard, the electric side, the stuff EUT does on that side of that. You'll also see us talking about the capacity of rural communities to address these issues. So might be at state and local government talking about comp plans, or might be over at the education committee talking about the Maine Service Fellows and the Maine Climate Corps, which is a public hearing that's happening right now and on a bill, and one of our colleagues is there. We work a little bit on transportation. In particular, we're concerned about the Maine State Ferry Service. We've been undertaking a year-long study of the Maine State Ferry Service. That's a community-focused needs assessment. We'll be sharing the results of that back with the Transportation Committee and others at the appropriate time. We're thrilled that Maine DOT received a $28 million grant to support the ferry to Islesboro becoming an electric ferry. That was really, really exciting to see. And then finally, the last place you'll probably see a lot of us on is rural broadband and broadband infrastructure. For those of you in Hancock and Waldo counties, the Island Institute is the regional and tribal broadband partner organization. And so that means we're supporting those communities in digital equity planning, broadband infrastructure planning. We're happy to be the first stop for questions if you have them. The Maine Connectivity Authority has funded us to provide local capacity, and we're working with organizations within each of these areas on these issues. Everybody, other organizations are supporting the rest of your districts and elsewhere in the state. Everybody in the state has a regional broadband partner. Happy to provide more information if you have questions on the broadband front or questions otherwise. Also, two other things. There are a couple of stickers in the packet that we handed out if you want. One of them says support Maine aquaculture. Sebastian just walked out, so he doesn't get a sticker, but and then the other thing is we put in two pieces that we recently wrote on climate change and whales and the future of the lobster industry. One is an op-ed on how we can make the best of the next 6 years, and the other is on the very strong climate signal that is underlying why whales are moving and changing where they are. That's been causing the state some challenge.
Representative Thorne and then Representative Dara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not even sure if you could answer this for me or not, but you brought it up, so I'll ask, see if you can. The $28 million grant to upgrade the ferries in Maine, just curious, you may not even know, but I have the question, do we know how many ferries there are in Maine that operate and what that upgrade entails?
Yes. So there are, the Maine State Ferry Service serves, I believe it's 6 or 7 year-round island communities. The there are a number of ferries that are in service. This $28 million is for part of a new ferry. So one new ferry. It would be a hybrid electric ferry, and it would serve the Islesboro run. So between Lincolnville Beach and Islesboro, it's a nationally leading project. Maine is at the forefront of ferry electrification, and this project really will put Maine on the map and put us ahead of everywhere else in the world. It's the run in Maine that makes the most sense for electrification. Just based on the grid infrastructure, where it goes, the timing, the size, the scale of the batteries, all of those things. But it's very exciting, and it's one run. The other ferries come out of either DOT's budget, bonding, capital improvements. So having the feds pay for almost all of the ferry is really, really significant. And when you look at ferries, I guess the one other thing, staffing costs and fuel costs are the two drivers of ticket price and operational costs. Everything else is fixed. And so we're not expecting staffing costs to go down or fuel costs to go down anytime soon. So
the other existing ones are diesel?
They are diesel. They burn about 900,000 gallons of diesel a year. So getting an electric ferry in the mix really helps a lot.
And this will more or less be a study to see how it goes or how efficient.
If it works, if things go as they hope it will, and they've had a bunch of naval architects come together and do the design of the ferry, and it's been well thought through, I think we'll see more of them where appropriate. It might not be appropriate for every run, mm-hmm. but we'll see that.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to add to that, what Nick said, that ferry is also the one, Representative Thorne, that gets that has the most trips going back and forth. It's just a 20-minute ferry. So it made a lot of sense to do the Islesboro one, and they needed a new ferry there. So it came in good timing. But my question is, I know that the Island Institute is in Rockland, but I'm wondering where you two live.
So I live about three houses away from Representative Duderre in Camden. We feed our chickens sometimes.
Yeah, and for context, I'm the third of four generations of my family to hold a commercial lobster license at one point in time. And I am from Damariscotta and know the chair of this committee from our time at Lincoln Academy.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. And I will leave this with the clerk.
Yes, that would be great. Thank you. Next up, Marissa McMahon. Yeah.
That's rare.
I think I had a student with that last name at some point. I don't think so.
No, I know. I'm like, I should have brought more.
All right. Is this on? I think it's on. Yeah. Okay. Good morning, Senator Rennie and distinguished members of the Joint Standing Committee on Marine Resources. I want to thank you for this opportunity to introduce the organization I work for. My name is Marissa McMahon. I'm the Director of Fisheries at a nonprofit organization called Manomet. And I'm also a lifelong Mainer from the coastal town of Georgetown. If you're not familiar with Manomet, we are a nonprofit that was founded in 1969 in Plymouth, Massachusetts, which might be why you're not familiar with us. We originally operated as a bird observatory, but have since expanded into many different sectors, including forestry, agriculture, and fisheries. Our work spans the entire Western Hemisphere, but our fisheries work specifically focuses on the Gulf of Maine, which is experiencing rapid, unprecedented change. And our fisheries office is based right in Brunswick. And we are a small team of three living here in Maine and working to promote resilient and productive coastal ecosystems and communities through applied science and community engagement. We work in partnership with coastal communities, with fishers, with other industry stakeholders to really co-develop climate change adaptation strategies that build greater social, ecological, and economic resilience. We have a fairly broad portfolio of projects we're working on. I won't have time to touch on all of them, but we do have the handout that should provide an overview of our work. And I want to just emphasize that sort of the glue that holds together all of this work is really starting from a position of listening to coastal community members, to stakeholders, hearing about the issues that they're dealing with, hearing about the observations from their day-to-day lives. We bring expertise in coastal ecosystem restoration, fisheries science, fisheries management, climate change adaptation, among other things, to the table. And together with stakeholders and communities, we co-develop strategies to build greater resilience. And I'll give some specific examples of what that looks like in just a moment. The work we're doing includes diversifying fisheries resources through the development of fisheries for emerging and invasive species, through exploring new aquaculture techniques and new aquaculture species. We are also supporting restoration and harvesting for river herring, which is an anadromous species that connects coastal and inland food webs. We conduct species and habitat monitoring in coastal ecosystems to understand how these systems are changing. We lead and support numerous efforts to strengthen shellfish co-management, which I'll talk about more in just a moment, and enhance shellfish resources in the state of Maine, And most recently, we've begun working to understand the impacts of sea level rise to intertidal habitat, shellfish resources, and harvester livelihoods. I do want to take a moment to expand upon the work we're doing in Maine's shellfish industry. That's one that we haven't really heard a whole lot about today yet. This is a large and growing part of our focus, and there was supposed to be a second handout that I wasn't able to actually bring with me that gave some great information and background on Maine shellfish industry. I will make sure that that gets emailed around to everyone. And that was actually put together by a University of Maine graduate student named Gabby Hillier. She's also part of an organization called the Maine Shellfish Learning Network, which is a close partner of ours and does a lot of really great work in the shellfish industry. The wild harvest shellfish industry in Maine is an incredibly important industry. It's been in existence for over 10,000 years. It's a very important part of Wabanaki culture. It supports 1,500 harvester livelihoods along the coast of Maine, and it is Maine's second most valuable fishery. In 2021, the value of landings was $25 million from this industry. The fishery is co-managed by municipalities and the DMR's Nearshore Fisheries Program. There's 75 municipalities along the coast of Maine that are actively managing their shellfish populations and the resource. It's important to point out that these municipal programs and harvesters associated with them are doing an immense amount to support and enhance their local shellfish populations. Through restoration, stock enhancement, water quality monitoring, community outreach, et cetera. And a large part of what Manomet does and what organizations like the Maine Shellfish Learning Network, the Casco Bay Regional Shellfish Working Group, the Down East Fisheries Partnership, and others, a lot of what they do is support the municipalities in doing this work because there's often very limited capacity and funding to do this type of shellfish conservation work. We also communicate regularly with the Bureau of Public Health and Nearshore Marine Fisheries Program at DMR. And I also hold the seat on DMR, the science seat on DMR's Shellfish Advisory Council, where we are currently undergoing a process to strengthen co-management of shellfish fisheries in Maine. The second area I'm going to expand on a little bit more, I was actually asked specifically to talk about this. It's more of a story from one of the projects that we've been working on for several years now, and it's a great example of the innovation and creativity and the sort of thinking outside the box mentality that a lot of fishers and communities are employing in Maine to help mitigate and adapt to climate change. So you all may have heard of green crabs. They're a very harmful invasive species. They are wreaking havoc on our shellfish populations, on our coastal ecosystems. They've actually been in Maine since the early 1900s, so they're not a new invasive species, but they're really thriving in recent years as waters have warmed. And so their populations are exploding in abundance, and they're a bigger problem now than they really ever have been before. So a few years ago, a group of folks got together actually in my hometown of Georgetown. And this was a group that was primarily made up of local volunteers and commercial fishermen. And we started asking what could be done about this problem. And one of the locals had actually been working in Venice, Italy at the time. And every seafood restaurant that he went to had a dish on the menu that looked exactly like deep fried soft shell green crabs. And come to find out that is in fact exactly what it was. So there's a centuries old fishery in Italy for green crabs, and it's very lucrative. We were able to connect with some of these Italian crab fishers and learned that they're selling their green crab product at upwards of $55 a pound. And so that was sort of what caught our interest at the beginning. And through multiple exchanges of ideas and actual exchanges of fishermen between Maine and Italy, as well as some key funding from Maine Sea Grant and NOAA, we were able to adapt these Italian fishing techniques here in Maine and produce the very first soft shell culinary green crab product in the United States. What's more, we were able to secure $30 a pound for this product directly going into the pockets of fishermen. And we worked really closely with chefs and restaurants in Midcoast Maine in particular, to really understand what the demand looked like. We learned that this was in fact a product that was in very high demand. As soon as chefs put it on their menus, they were selling out immediately. Unfortunately, right as we were gaining all of this momentum, the pandemic hit. And so that really kind of knocked the legs out from underneath this project. It's taken a really long time to regain interest from the fishing community and culinary community in particular, because of course, both of those industries have been under incredible strain from continued pandemic disruptions. However, I am happy to say that now there are a few fishers who are again producing softshell green crabs. And there's a few others who are actually taking advantage of other markets for this species, including the bait market, which primarily operates out of southern New England, but is actually buying hundreds of thousands of pounds of green crabs a year at this point. So that's another great potential opportunity. And I share this story to just highlight that there are opportunities that can be found even where you wouldn't think to look for them. Green crabs are an invasive pest, essentially, but it doesn't mean that we can't find ways to benefit from this species and to create ways for fishers and coastal communities to benefit. I think it's that sort of innovative and creative mindset that we have here in Maine, and with support from legislators like you and from funders who also sort of think outside the box, we have a lot of opportunity to work on diversifying Maine's fisheries and fisheries resources and supporting Maine's coastal communities. I'm gonna stop there. I could talk about some of our other projects, but for the sake of time, I'll stop there and just say that, you know, we really see ourselves as a resource for you all on this committee. We're a non-advocacy organization, so we won't advocate on any particular piece of legislation, but we are happy to be scientific, you know, bring scientific expertise to bear on particular issues, to share our experiences, you know, as they relate to the bills that you'll be seeing during this session. And we're more than happy to provide expertise on anything that falls within our scope of work. So thank you for your time and happy to answer questions if you have any.
Representative Dill and then Representative Thorne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's the window on the soft shell green crab?
Like the seasonal timing?
Yeah.
So it's an early spring. Well, it depends a little bit on where you are. You know, it starts earlier in the southern part of the state and then sort of progresses. It depends on when the crabs are molting because they need to be in that soft shell phase. So we're seeing that in the mid-coast area, it's typically starts in April and goes through June. So we kind of think of this as a potential, you know, opportunity for lobstermen in particular who could diversify and be able to target this species maybe before they're getting all of their gear in the water or when it's a little bit of the slower season, as well as, you know, clam diggers and others who aren't as active during that time of year.
And so just out of curiosity, are they the same thing as like with the blue crabs and soft shell, they just serve them whole, fried, throw them in a sandwich or whatever?
Yep, absolutely.
They're super soft at that point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you ever find anybody who develops a black fly mosquito soup with a side of milfoil, we'd be interested in that. I remember, I think it was on the tour out to Beals Island where someone said that they did a test with a wooden box and they put a mesh screen over the top of the box in the sand on the beach. And there were all these eggs, clam eggs that happened naturally. Well, they went out and they harvested around the box was like a clam here or there. Inside the box where the green crabs couldn't get to, there were like dozens and dozens and dozens of clams. So, and they said that they'll eat those eggs, just scoop them and go.
Yeah, and that's one of the major issues with green crabs is that a lot of the damage they cause is when they're really small. So if you're trapping for them in a fishery, you're not targeting them when they're in that really small phase. So, you know, we can't necessarily know that this is going to have beneficial positive impact on species like softshell clams, but instead we're sort of focused more on the benefit that it can bring as a diversified source of income to fishers.
It's here, it's not going anywhere, right?
We can't eradicate that at this
point. And is that a process of the warming waters or just migration? Is it north to south or to other states down the East Coast have the same issue?
Yeah, so they invaded in 1817, brought over from Europe and shipped ballast water. And they invaded most likely down by the Chesapeake Bay area and then made their way up. And they arrived in Maine in the early 1900s. So they've been here a long time. But the issue right now is that the warming water is really causing the populations to, you know, thrive and increase in abundance.
I see.
So they're more abundant than possibly ever before, which is really why we're seeing, you know, decimation of softshell clams and, you know, eelgrass habitat, salt marsh habitat also being negatively impacted.
Mm. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Dudera.
Thank you very much. I love that you told the story about the Venetian fishermen because I read that in Down East, I believe, way back. And I might have said this to some of you folks who are on the tour. I don't think I said it last week in here, but I met a student of Representative Osher's a couple summers ago who was at UMaine, and he was in Camden doing some research on the invasive green crabs, trying to determine when they molt. Because it's my understanding that if they're not soft shell, they're too hard and it's too expensive to pick them because there's for the small amount of meat you're going to get. So he was actually trying to pinpoint, and I guess that the fishermen in Italy can do this like intuitively, like they've just got the sixth sense of when they're molting. But he said what he thinks it's going to come down to, and this guy was not a marine biologist, he's just an entrepreneur, sees an opportunity. He had read about it in Down East too, is either ultrasound technology or AI. And I just wonder, have you heard of this? Do you know who this guy is? Okay, Joe. He made me some crab cakes with them and they were delicious. We saw one molt right while we were there. Okay, good. Tell us about Joe.
Did it turn off? Oh, okay. So one of the things that we really focused on is, you know, figuring out the biology of the molt cycle and then also how you can recognize those molt signs. And you're right, the Venetians can do it in their sleep with their eyes closed. Like they're just, yeah. And we're not that good at it. Although we've been able to, you know, get pretty good at it. But yes, I think where we want to see this go now is for entrepreneurs like Joe and, you know, others. There's a lot of different folks working in this space to sort of take this knowledge and then, you know, build some sort of next step, next business out of it. And so I think what they're doing is really fascinating in terms of trying to use technology to sort of help with that identification of those pre-molt crabs. So yeah, absolutely. I think that's where we hope to see, you know, the continued innovation and the continued sort of building upon the groundwork.
When they're used for bait, are they just used no matter when and just ground up?
Yeah, it's exactly. So they can be in any state, hard shell, soft shell. So it's a lot easier to get rid of the hard shell product into the bait market. It pays a lot less. So, you know, anywhere from 50 cents to $1 a pound. And most of the time it has to get out of state to southern New England. So that's a bit of a hurdle, but it's not, you know, completely stopping progress. There's actually one company in Southern Maine right now that is selling to a Southern New England market. And I believe they sold like upwards of 30,000 pounds of green crabs just this year to the bait market. So
any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. And it looks like next up we have the Maine Seaweed Council. You want to come introduce yourselves?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the Joint Standing Committee. I want to thank you for the opportunity to introduce ourselves My name is Bonnie Toby, and I work for Source. I'm the operations manager for Source Micronutrients. We've been in business since 1975. I'm also the current president of the Maine Seaweed Council, which is what brings me here today. And I just want to give you a nice overview, summary of what the council is and what we do. And then I'm going to turn it over to a couple of our board member council members as well to help out. So the Maine Seaweed Council was established in 1993 with the following mission and purpose. And that was to protect the ecosystems of Maine's marine algae, develop and adhere to sustainable cultivation and harvest practices, promote the use of Maine seaweeds, educate the public, regulators, and elected officials to provide a collaborative forum for its members. And we are a diverse group made up of harvesters, growers, buyers, processors, researchers, students, artists, and interested parties. We are a nonprofit organization, and membership and partners number over 100. And as you know, harvesting in Maine is not new. It's been around for a long time. So this wonderful picture here from 1882, we appreciate the use of it from the Heritage New England Archives. Kind of shows a little bit of the history of Maine and harvesting. And by the early 1970s, infrastructure was needed to process this seaweed. So companies were founded and a lot of jobs were created back then. Today, many types of seaweeds are harvested, both wild and farmed. Maine has over 10 edible seaweeds, and they're very colorful and beautiful. So you can see them there. And whether they're farmed or wild, seaweed has a lot of uses. And that's one of the big questions we feel is, what are the uses? What does it go into? So nutritional supplements for people and pets, of course, and pharmaceuticals, nutraceuticals, cosmetics, skincare, art, fertilizers, extracts, biostimulants. Seaweed not only provides food directly, but it also helps to grow other food more efficiently, which is wonderful. And I do want to just cite a local study that was done a couple of years ago, and George may be able to speak to that further if you have questions. But this was a farm, a potato farm in Aroostook County, and they put seaweed extract on it, and the seaweed extract increased the yield by 3,000 potatoes per acre with no additional fertilizers or pesticides. And that is wonderful. And that's just that much less going off into our waterways. The Maine Seaweed Council has been a partner in research since its inception in 93. Some of our current collaborations include providing testing material for the cow methane research that is being done by Bigelow Laboratories and Associates, assisting researchers from the University of Maine, Maine Maritime Academy, Maine Sea Grant, Scudic Institute, and others in their study on conserving rockweed animal systems for a sustainable harvest. They call it CRASH. prior to 2019, members of industry, science, conservation, and the Department of Marine Resources collaborated to create the fisheries management plan for rockweed. Due to an unfortunate ruling in Ross versus Acadia, the fisheries management plan was never made official, though it does continue to be a guiding document for us. And the Maine Seaweed Council is currently working on a very extensive document for best sustainability practices, taking all that we've learned from the fisheries management plan, the decades of experience, but it's being expanded to all of the different species of seaweeds, so that whether you are a seasoned seaweed person or somebody just coming in, you will have the guidelines needed to make sure that all of those species are taken care of. And I'm going to ask George to come up next here and just talk a little bit about the issues and practical implications of ownership, some of the challenges that we deal with. So, stay? Okay. I'll slide right over.
Good afternoon, Senator Rennie, and you rest of you who have made it. My name is George Seaver, and I was processing in 1977 with the early, well, you have a picture of my original boss there. That was from down east. I'm not a lawyer and I'm not a realtor, but in the course of this issue about, well, who actually owns the intertidal zone, I've been part of a lot of conversations and listened quite a bit. I promised myself I would read and not wander. In March of 2019, the Maine High Court ruled that seaweed attached to rocks belonged to the owner of that area of the intertidal zone. In reaching that opinion, the court explicitly did not consider the question of intertidal ownership. Instead, the legal focus was if seaweed was a fishery. The Maine legislature has not reconciled that court decision with the longstanding laws, regulations, definitions that have been Maine's law of the land with respect to the historical relationship between Mainers and the marine resources located in the intertidal zone. Specifically, all of the regulations define seaweed as a fishery, thus including it on the list of harvestable marine resources available to the public since about 1647. This is in direct contrast with the court's ruling. This conundrum is what you guys are going to be faced with, and I'm now editorializing. So I'm hoping that what you get from this is, wow, this is a mess. So property taxes, again, not a realtor. Property taxes for homes with frontage on the shore are calculated based on the appraised market value of that property. The adjacent acreage below mean high water is seldom measured and never appraised for local property taxes. If it were, the property taxes would actually increase by at least the value of the claimed marine resources. Considering the obligations and liabilities associated with owning those acres, it's probably better for the landowners not to own the sand, mud, and slippery rocks. It's some landowners think that if they lose what they consider to be their ownership, that they've somehow been punished. Protecting the ecosystem. Rockweed has been commercially harvested for centuries in Maine and Canada, and in fact, the rest of the coastlines facing the North Atlantic Ocean. When done properly, it improves the health of the seaweed resource and supports the other living critters who rely on it. Of the over 3,000 miles of Maine coastline, only a small percentage is practical to harvest. It was estimated by the University of Maine that seasonal factors such as ice and wave action harvest on average roughly 40% of the biomass per year. Commercial harvesting in total has slowly climbed to less than 3% of the standing rockweed resource during the past 50 years. It was harvested in Maine, in Booth Bay actually, back in the 1860s. So it's been going on a long time. The part I know about is the part that I was here for. The picture on the front relates to the next section. It's my beach and it's private. Well, regardless of the legal conclusion at the end of the title searches, it remains longstanding common law that fishing, fowling, and navigating are allowed in the intertidal zone. All the intertidal zone. The courts have traditionally been lenient with respect to what's included under those three categories. For example, scuba diving was considered navigating in a case not too long ago. According to DMR and even the IRS, harvesting seaweed is fishing. Property lines. Assuming again, and when I say assuming the title searches, the Ross ruling said that, or acknowledged the possibility that the person who lived up the hill wasn't actually the owner. So you do have to go back to the 1700s sometimes to find a deed where the person could prove they owned it or not. The next speaker has been down in the weeds on that subject, so I won't go there. Assuming again that the title searches supported that a parcel of intertidal zone were privately owned and the owner didn't want the seaweed harvested, that landowner would need to have a survey done that would go to the current low water mark, legally define the property lines, and put signs up to communicate that the seaweed on that property should not be harvested. The sign would need to be specific to seaweed because clams, mussels, and worms can still be harvested. The property lines would need to be evident regardless of the coming and going tide, meaning kind of a problem. We've had several people refer to climate change. This is a real thing. Rising water levels along the shore. In an unfortunate future where municipalities or the state consider constructing barriers or seawalls to protect shore residences, it will be necessary to have public ownership of these areas where protective construction might be warranted. Privately held beaches would open financial, legal, and permitting cans of worms that I can't even imagine. One of the things, there was an effort legislatively a few years ago to try and clarify the ownership. And one of the things that a lot of senators and representatives heard that helped them reach a position was that it would be a taking if the state returned the ownership to the public. My response to that is, it would be a taking if the state clarifies, or the comment was, it would be a taking if the state clarified that the intertidal zone is a public resource. The state would owe the property shore owners payments for their loss, a great liability to the state. Well, it would only be a taking if the market value of that shore property decreased. And the market value of shore property depends on the view, not the amount of seaweed. Fishing, fowling, and navigating are still allowed regardless of ownership. So there's no financial impact to who we think owns it. And you don't even affect what goes on there, with the possible exception of seaweed. So where is the taking? There are hundreds of jobs and millions of dollars associated with the decades-old seaweed processing businesses. We compete internationally. We are a small player in a world full of people producing seaweed extracts. If the growth or survival of these businesses were hurt by the uncertainties of access to the needed raw material, there will be financial damage to those businesses that likely would be a taking. I'm not sure how that would ever get pursued, but I can tell you, I'm glad I'm old, because somebody's gonna have a problem with this. Just to continue that, that's the end of my formal part, but I just wanted to bolster a little bit of what Bonnie said about the potatoes. That was the first thing that I did with potatoes back in the 80s, early 80s. And we found that we could get a 5 to maybe 10% increase in yield with a gallon of this extract. Pretty amazing. No extra fertilizer, no extra pesticides. It's a matter of eliciting growth responses in potatoes. And I hesitate to say this out loud, but it fundamentally boils down to, and potatoes is just a good heavy example, but pounds of seaweed can produce tons of food. It is literally pounds of seaweed produce tons of food in the extraction biostimulant side of it. So if there's any questions for me, I'm ready.
Yeah, Representative Dudera. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. When you harvest rockweed, are you cutting it to a certain length? Are you yanking it out? How do you do that?
By law, there she is. By law, so I got to say this right. You can't cut more than 16 inches. It has to be 16 inches still there. Our company hand harvests. We don't need as much as people who dehydrate it, but we hand harvest and the person cuts it and leaves it. The thing that's important to kind of come to grips with is people don't like to work hard. And the easiest way to harvest seaweed is to take the big plants that are floating the highest. You would be crazy to overharvest. There's no reason to overharvest. You'd be breaking your back for no reason. So yes, we cut it. There's also harvesters that do a beautiful job of not going too far down the plant. And the mechanical harvesters also graze looking for where the seaweed is the biggest.
We run mechanical harvesters. We run two at a time, and they were specifically designed so that you can't cut. My brother likens it to like a lawnmower. If you had a lawnmower, you could let it run all day long, and it wouldn't cut any more than it's going to cut. So it's predetermined, and that's why if mechanical harvesters work so well in that respect. They're kind of slow and ugly, but they work.
Brian Beal compares it to tipping to make wreaths. You don't kill any trees, you just take the tips.
We should get
John.
Yeah, roll in here.
John is an amazing title searcher.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Senator Rennie and members of the Joint Standing Committee on Marine Resources. My name is John Groton. I'm the resource manager for North American Kelp. It's a rockweed processing facility that's been operating in Waldoboro, Maine for 52 years. In my time in working in the industry, I've seen many changes, but none of them have affected our industry as heavily or as negatively as the Ross versus Acadian Sea Plants Limited case adjudicated in 2019. This case stating that the ownership of attached rockweed can privately be owned is incongruous with Maine's marine resources laws, statutized in Title 12 and Title 1, and Maine's common law. The Ross decision, stating that the riparian owner can hold title and fee to rockweed growing in the intertidal zone, does not take into account that the majority of the intertidal lands in Maine were intended to be held in trust for the public. Town proprietors conveyed parcels whose boundaries stopped at mean high watermark, but gave propriety to the riparian owner. This meant that the riparian owner could build docks, wharfs, and other implements to aid in marine commerce without the threat of adverse possession or other loss rising from public use. Again, this is done in an effort to aid marine commerce, not hinder it. This public ownership of intertidal lands is thoroughly documented in resources such as the Cumberland Original Proprietor's Shoreline Reservation Study by Ann Wagner, as prepared for the town of Cumberland, August 15th in 1978. This study was conducted in Maine's intertidal lands from York to the Kennebec River and concluded that the intertidal lands were held in trust for the public. This study further researched and supported and elaborated on by Orlando DeLogue, Professor Emeritus from the Maine Law School in Maine Beaches Are Public Property, published in 2017. And again, ownership is supported by Edwin Churchill in The Great Land Grab, Maine Beaches Ripped from the True Owners, the Town Inhabitants, published in 2019. What we are facing today is a casual degradation of public trust rights in the intertidal lands of Maine. Maine case law has stated that ownership of discrete parcels of intertidal lands can be conveyed in private entities through construction of deeds, the language of which is incredibly important. When a deed defines a property as having a seaward boundary that extend to the shore, to the flats, to the bank, all intend to convey parcels that stop at the high water mark. Conversely, when a deed defines properties as having seaward boundaries to the sea, the river, the waters, they all imply the parcels to be owned at the mean low water mark. The problem lies in conveyances made over the years. Conveyance after conveyance, especially when parcels are split or into several others, tend to change the language when used in defining boundaries. If the author of the deed is not aware of the implications that come when selecting boundary language, the seaward boundary can be moved accidentally and without ever the realization having it occurred. As the legal nemo dat rule states, no one can give what they do not have. I've seen this time and time again in my researching of parcels. It is the norm, not the exception, that the boundary language has changed. I bring forward these points today to outline and accentuate the discord between Maine's statutized laws as found at Maine's Title I and Title 12 and the decisions handed down through the courts, and to point out that while ownership of Maine's intertidal lands is all but settled, the Maine legislature has long since declared that it owns the marine resources adjoining our coast. In Title I, Chapter 1, Subsection 2A, the state of Maine declares that it owns and controls the harvesting of the living resources adjoining our coastline for a distance of 200 miles or to the furthest edge of the continental shelf, whichever is greater, subject only to the boundary of Canada. Control over the harvesting of these living resources shall be held by licenses or permits issued by the Department of Marine Resources. The marine resources adjoining our coast must be owned and managed by the state for the benefit of all. This is the way things should be and always have been in Maine. To try to change that now after 200 years goes against the laws and customs of our state. I have a bunch of definitions from our Title 12 and Title 1 in here that define what fishing is, what our boundaries are, and why seaweed harvesting is a fishery. That's all I have today. Yes, I have copies for everyone as well.
Any questions? Yeah, Representative Strout.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So on the fertilizer part of it, my father has been in the fertilizer business for a long time. It's Buzz Pinkham, Damascotta, and I think you guys may have worked with him. So I guess my question is, as the PFAS things go through and we're losing the fertilizers and the farmlands, seaweed seems to be a good opportunity to substitute for that and make that, you know, the clean way to go. So how does this affect the harvesting and the amount to contribute if you're getting cut off by what you can gather?
Well, as far as PFAS, it is a great concern in Maine. One thing that we're seeing in the seaweed industry is that we're not having the problems with it as they are on land. So they're trying to define ways to test the seaweed and on a laboratory standard. That's another thing that they're currently developing. If we have less access, there's going to be less inputs that we can put into that arena, into that farming aspect. We've seen more and more pushback from upland landowners and entities, and just the public perception that where rockweed can be owned, in the courts it was promulgated that it is owned by the riparian owner, and it's simply not the case. The hundreds of research or parcels that I researched, it's the majority of them that it's not the case at all. And that over the years, that language has changed. And it now implies that it is owned to the low water mark.
With respect to the fertilizer question more specifically, and PFAS does not tend to happen in the ocean water where all the nutrients for the seaweed come from. We don't replace fertilizer. We make the fertilizer that someone already uses 10% more effective. So you get, you know, I've talked to potato growers, and the last thing they want to do is have a little less yield with even much less fertilizer. They would rather use the same fertilizer and get more potatoes. As time goes by, and as the cost of fertilizers go up, if anything, it strengthens our position because we're going to give you more potatoes for that fertilizer, whatever you used. And we've been doing research all over the country, right? Around the world a little bit, that documents the response to this biostimulant. It's not providing fertility, it's providing signals to the plants, and it's all kinds of plants. So yeah, the other thing that I wanted to stick here for what John was just saying is several of us at this microphone today have talked about gentrification being one of the problems. We are ground zero for that problem. In fact, I wish all the realtors in the world would say, isn't it beautiful out there? Aren't you glad you don't have to pay taxes on it? You can look at it. That's the value of your property, what you can see, not what you can slip in. And if people coming with the money from the house they sold in New Jersey knew that what they were buying was the view and not the mud, all of our lives would be better.
Any other questions? Representative Thorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was born this way.
Must have been painful.
Who has more fun than us, huh? My question is there something uniquely obvious or obnoxious about harvesting rockweed that would make people have such a fuss over it? Is it the extended periods of time spent in front of a particular home that is an annoyance, or what's the
I think you get three. I'll give you my answer.
Yeah.
Because we don't. We hand harvest very quietly, and you, in order to be efficient at it, you move around.
At low tide.
Well, or low, or half tide.
If you half tide.
You can do it at high tide.
Okay.
So we go back to the same regions. We harvest mostly out of friendship. Most of our seaweed comes from around that way. And we haven't had too many people unhappy. Now, if we aren't making any noise at all, except we're making no noise at all. If you have a mechanical harvester and go there every third year.
Yeah, that's the mechanical harvesters. Obviously, they're like a lobster boat. And some lobster boats are much, much louder. We have hooked them up to decibel readers, and they're not louder than anything else. It's just, your point is good, that if it's close to somebody's house, they simply don't like that. And that's just the way that is. But George has a very good point. We have tried in every possible way to be as considerate as possible, because we do rotate, like a farmer rotates their crops, we rotate our ledges. So they're only going to see us for probably a couple of weeks every 3 years. And that's enough for them to complain, but that's just the way that is. We're not there at all. We're not even there on the weekends. We don't harvest Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. So it's just one of those things where we try to be very considerate, and thankfully we do have good relationships with a lot of the places that we do harvest, because we've been there for so long. So we're very fortunate in that respect. Unfortunately, at least in my humble opinion, is that when the Ross decision ruled on seaweed as being somebody's shrub, which is exactly what it was deemed as, that gave a lot of people the impetus to simply say, oh, I didn't know that. That's my shrub. Then I don't want you to harvest my shrub. So it's just really, really, really important to understand that seaweed is a fishery, just like any other fishery. It's been around for a long, 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 long time. Definitely considered a fishery by the state of Maine, by the IRS, all the things that we've gone over, and fishing, fowling, and navigation is a right for Mainers. And so we are indeed ground zero in that respect.
Maybe if you tell them you're trimming their rockweed for them at a no cost.
Yeah. People
they wouldn't mind if I came with my lawnmower.
Thank you.
People ask us sometimes to harvest.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Representative Bucket and then Representative Strout.
Thank you.
No.
There we go. Just for clarification, so you're not on their property, correct? You do everything coming in on the water.
Yes.
Okay. So you're not crossing or getting on the beach or anything.
Some of them think it's their property because of this. Court ruling that said, well, the court ruling didn't say they own it. The court ruling didn't address it. There was a court case that created this Moody Beach sign that I passed out that in the 80s, I think it was, that was just flawed reasoning. And we're working to try and get that corrected now. There's a court case going on as we speak.
Thank you.
My response to Representative Thorne's question would be, it's not so much for us that people see us harvesting in front of their property. They're opposed to it from a sustainability standpoint. And that's because there's this misconception that it's being over harvested, where rockweed is a baseline for all these other species that are out there in this intertidal zone. They use it for cover and food and everything else. There's this misconception that when we harvest it, we're depleting this and it's gone and it's everything else is just being scoured. And it's simply not the case. I think our largest year was 2017. I think we harvested 22 million pounds of seaweed were landed in the state. That's between 1-2% of the standing biomass that's out there. So it's, again, very, very small amounts.
Big numbers, small percents.
Most of the coast of Maine is not accessible to harvest anyway. So there's that to consider. So to be able to harvest the little places that we can is crucial.
It puts more stress on the areas that are accessible when you're limiting it through upland entities' discretion.
Representative Strout.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that was actually a follow into my question, the aquaculture. So growing seaweed on ropes and things like that, is that something that is a sustainable or an upcoming industry or what you...
I love it. I love it for rockweed. The problem with it is the scale. And rockweed taking 3 years to really go from like a starting stage to something that you can do something with. There's a lot of time with that and just the scale and the prevalence of ASCO in Maine. It's all over the place. It's a resource that is waiting to be utilized. And if we're just putting it into private entities' hands for conservation reasons, it's a waste. I mean, it is a benefit, but we're not taking that economic benefit back in our communities from it.
It's so abundant. The rockweed is so abundant that if you do a cost analysis, yes, you can grow it, but why would you?
Any other questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Yeah. Are all three of you from Waldoboro? Are all three of you from Waldoboro? Oh, okay. Oh, you're in Bath. Okay. So I think next up, I believe Kristen Porter is joining us via Zoom. She's from the Maine Lobstermen's Association. Oh, hello.
Hi there.
He's from the Maine Lobstermen's Association and his video's on.
Okay.
He's unmuted. Let's.
Am I all set? Can everybody hear me?
Go for it.
Okay, great. Good afternoon, Senator Rennie and distinguished members of the Joint Standing Committee on Marine Resources. So I'm sorry I couldn't be there in person today to speak with you, but I'll try to make it before the session is over. I also want to apologize for our executive director, Patrice McCarron, who usually does these things as well. She was on an all-day whale meeting that she couldn't get away from. MLA is the oldest and largest fisheries organization on the East Coast. We've been around since 1954. Our mission statement is to advocate for a sustainable lobster resource and the fishermen and communities that depend on it. We fluctuate between 1,000 and 1,200 members annually, and we have 21 board members. Those board members are elected by the members, and they represent towns up and down the coast. We range from Cutler to Kennebunk. So as most of you know, lobster is the second largest industry in the state behind tourism. And in my humble opinion, the reason that tourism is so strong is partly because of the lobster industry. And in 2021, we landed 108 million pounds worth $750 million at the dock. So that's just the dock price. So if you figure in what the trickle effect of that is and all the shoreside infrastructure and everything, we're pushing $2 billion added to the Maine economy. So we are an owner-operator fishery. Every fisherman, every boat you see on a dock, on a mooring, is an independent business owner. And we have about 4,000 of those. And lobstering right now is the lifeblood of coastal communities, especially the smaller coastal communities. That's all they have. If it wasn't for us, there wouldn't be young people, there wouldn't be small schools. So that's our passion. That's what we're fighting for, is these small communities to keep this industry and this way of life going. And that's why, as most of you know, we've been the leader in challenging the whale rules that have been pushed upon us and the future coming. We still, with all that's been going on and what you're hearing, 2030 is basically the expiration date of the lobster fishery if nothing changes. So that's why we've raised a lot of money through our legal defense fund. And we're going as hard as we can to make sure that the industry survives. We're also, as most of you know, there's offshore wind is coming. We are going to be on the front lines of that too, assuring that it doesn't adversely affect the fishing industry, not only taking away bottom, but if these things disturb the flow of the ocean, if they do anything on the bottom to disrupt the reproduction of lobsters or the migration of lobsters, we want to make sure that that research is done and that our industry that's been here for generations isn't affected or isn't eliminated. So we have a lot of pressures on the lobster fishery right now. Our association still deals with legislative stuff. And I haven't had a chance to look at all the bills coming up, but I know there are a few, and we will weigh in on most of them. Our board will meet and decide, and we have a position on most state, you know, legislature bills. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions anybody may have.
Any burning questions? Yeah, Representative Strout.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I've been following the lobster industry, and I've gone to the NOAA things and spoken and presented testimony. And for me, I think the most I've learned from this is that sometimes the research isn't always as true that shared as it could be. So for me, I'm looking for the lobster industry and my son fishes. So I get a lot of stuff from him. But I just think that's important to know that, you know, some of the stuff that's been presented about the lobster fishing industry, you wouldn't know isn't true unless you were involved in it. So being able to communicate, I appreciate all the stuff that everybody's done to share and keep the industry going. And I look forward to working with you guys to keep that industry alive and sustainable heritage going. So thank you for all the work that you guys have done.
Great, thank you. And that kind of leads me to our legal defense fund is not only the donations we get from fishermen and businesses and everything else, isn't just for legal fees. We have a four-pronged approach. It's legal and legislative. It's also part of that is research. And we have, you know, we intend to fund independent research to challenge what some of the research that the government, the federal government's doing and other groups. Communications is part of it to get that information out to the general public and to the fishermen as well, so they can make smart business plans. And also, we also have the fourth prong is gear research. And we're gonna be looking at alternatives to some of the stuff that they're throwing at us to, you know, that if it comes to it, the industry can survive with some innovative common sense gear.
Thank you. Any other questions at the moment? Oh, great. Thank you so much. Thank everybody you for letting us learn a little bit more about your organizations.
Great. Thank you.
So, all right. That, I believe, was the last presentation that we have slated for the day. Does anybody have any further questions or comments? Could be a okay time to move to adjourn then. All right.
I'll second.
Okay. All in favor?